Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This week in Retronauts, we open the pod bay doors. Everyone, and welcome to episode mystery of Retronauts. I don't know what number this is going to be because we record them in batches in advance. It's the Costco approach.
I bet it's 53.
Maybe.
I'm just guessing.
You could be right. I actually don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm hosting this week. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and crowding into this tiny, hot, unventilated little studio, we have, as usual,
I am RWM. Because we're talking about HAL today.
Oh.
Yeah. Which stands for nothing, but they stand for good games, I think. I'm a little loopy from the last episode.
That's Bob Mackey.
Yeah, hi.
Also, next to Bob.
I'm HLG. Henry, sorry. Well, I have at least two of the letters of Henry.
Everybody needs to do this now.
I'm Henry Gilbert. Hi.
Hello. And finally.
I don't have any of the letters overlap. It's just Christian Nutt from Gama Sutra.
Hi, Christian. Thanks for joining us. So, yes, this week we are talking about HAL, HAL Laboratories, kind of as a tribute to Satoru Iwata, who news of his passing broke during our last recording session for Retronauts, and we all agreed we should do an episode on HAL because he played such an integral part in that studio. And so here we are, paying tribute to his work and also the company he helped establish. So I'm not sure how this one's going to go. It's one of those that's going to be kind of a historical breakdown, and maybe we'll end up talking about some games. There are some games definitely that they've made that we've played and probably have a lot to say about, but this isn't necessarily about the games themselves more as much as it is the company. What was your first experience with HAL, everyone? I'm just curious. Like, when did you become aware of their existence?
Let's see. I played the Kirby games in their day on the NES and Super NES, but I think when I really recognized HAL as like a name on stuff was like their Pokemon work on N64, actually, like as the logo of the cute dog and all that stuff. Like Pokemon and Smash Brothers. Those were the two big ones for me, I think.
Yeah, I think it was the same for me. Just seeing their name on things that I thought were Nintendo games. I mean, that they were Nintendo games, but the idea of there being like a second party or like another developer was weird to me. But I'm pretty sure I played The Adventures of Lolo. That was my first HAL game. Yeah. And it made me learn to hate Sokoban or whatever you want to call it.
Lolo's great, though. It's so much better than Sokoban.
I love how cute it is, but man, is it hard.
Yeah, no, I'd probably say Adventures of Lolo is where I sort of became aware of HAL as an entity. They made NES games. I never really paid that much attention to HAL in that era. Starting on the SNES, I started to pay a little more attention. I always wanted to play Kirby games, but they always came out at the end of the generation.
Mm-hmm.
And always, the NES and SNES, I kept skipping the Kirby games.
Gosh, Christian, you sound so muted. Anyway, the first awareness I had of HAL, like I saw their logo on boxes, but the first time I was really like, HAL was when their logo appeared in that blitz of developer logos at the beginning of Earthbound. It's like 20 different logos. Ape, HAL, Nintendo.
Were they Halkin? on that screen?
They've been Halcon sometimes. I don't know what that name is about. I didn't see
I any... do know what it's about.
Oh, what is that about?
So it stands for HAL Kenkyūjō, which means like HAL Laboratory in Japanese.
So it's Japanese. There you go. So they've been around. If you owned a Nintendo system throughout the years, you almost certainly have played a HAL game. Whether you like Kirby or Smash Brothers or just odd little NES games that people kind of vaguely remember, like Air Fortress.
Yeah, the weird HAL game I realized that is the first time I like deliberately remember buying a HAL game, like looking at the ad, deciding to buy the game, was Arcana for the SNES.
Oh, that
looks so cool.
I love that game. So anyway, HAL was established in February of 1980. And it was basically just a bunch of dudes who kind of knew each other in college and would hang out and program video games together for their own amusement. And eventually they kind of said, why don't we make a company out of this? And they did. I had trouble when I was doing research for this episode finding exactly when they published their first game. Like some sources say 1981 and some sources say 1985.
Hmm.
So my thought is probably that their early games pre-1985 were just sort of like, you know, that mail order in the back of a magazine style, like we make our own 5 1/4 inch diskettes and put them in a plastic bag and mail them to you.
The notion of publishing was quite nascent at the time.
So they did the Akalabeth thing. And then I think 1985 was their first actual published, available at retail in a package, proper video game.
The story about their founding was that it was some people who were involved in the computer department at Seibu Department Store in Tokyo. Have you ever heard this?
I haven't heard that.
No.
No, like what I heard was that, and I should have reread it before saying this, I guess, but so Seibu is a big department store chain in Japan, that the people who worked in the computer department or something, like they had demo machines there and people, like what I'd read was Iwata came in and would like mess around with the demo machines and show off the stuff he was working on when he was like really young. And that impressed them, and like that's how he got involved. Whether they were the people who worked at the department store or they came to the department store also, and it was sort of like a commingling gathering place for like early programmers in Tokyo.
I did not see that information anywhere online, but it sounds plausible, and I want to believe that's the case.
It does seem like the bunch of college buddies is a very common like early Japanese developer story. Like
yeah,
Square,
I mean they really were like at the beginning just kind of your prototypical standard Japanese little developer making computer games that, you know, a few hundred people would play.
Right, Enix.
Yeah, exactly. Like we talked in the Dragon Quest episode about how Enix had these competitions where people would just like send in game concepts. And it really was this sort of like guerrilla off-the-cuff market. The Japanese computer PC market took a while to become established.
They all did. Globally speaking, you know, there wasn't an infrastructure, and the companies that manufactured the computers didn't give the same kind of boost that you would expect from like a quote unquote platform holder these days.
But you did see in the West sort of companies develop as publishers like Infocom and you know some other publishers.
Broderbund,
along those lines. Broderbund
was very much a publisher. Yep, right?
And you know, Enix was one of the early ones along those lines. But for the most part, it was just like anyone and everyone. You know, just like in the UK with the Spectrum scene, it was just tons of tiny little developers no one ever hears about these days. HAL was one of those that actually managed to survive and, you know, went beyond that marketplace. And eventually they switched entirely from PC development to console development, which is kind of the way the Japanese games industry went, I think. But they were definitely sort of on the early lip of that transition. Anyway, so the name HAL, not surprisingly, comes from HAL 9000, the artificial intelligence in the movie 2001. That's been a big influence on Japanese game developers. I mean, how many HALs are there in video games? There was obviously Otacon in Metal Gear Solid, who there's even a HAL Dave joke at the end of Metal Gear Solid. If you get if you let Meryl die, but why would you
Spoilers.
Do that?
Spoilers!
Don't do that.
Sometimes you're not fast enough at pressing a button, man. That's all.
And remember, there are no continues, my friend.
I heard something else too.
Oh yeah,
this could be coincidence, but every letter of their name is one less than IBM. Okay, so this is where IBM. I'm going. Okay, I'm sorry.
Did you read my notes?
I did, but I just glanced at them. I'm sorry.
So in the movie, or the book, the novel by Arthur C. Clarke, HAL stood for Heuristic Algorithmic, which was the name, like the description of the computer processes, that generated its artificial intelligence. But someone noticed at some point that HAL is one letter in the alphabet before IBM for each character. And we're like, hey, were you trying to make a statement about IBM? And Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick were like, no, that was not intentional. And actually, IBM was one of our partners on this movie, and we weren't trying to assassinate them or, you know, impugn them. If we had noticed that, we probably would have changed HAL's name. But they didn't.
Okay.
And so so that kind of became an element of lore. But according to the Zombie U episode or edition of Iwata Asks, Iwata said, yeah, we actually latched onto that. We wanted to be one ahead of IBM in every respect. So
they borrowed their name. U?
Yeah, right?
Okay. He'll get weird every once – like, yeah, that's why you have to read every Iwata Ask, because he'll just drop knowledge at any point. He's like, you know, that reminds me of when I was 26, and he'll just like spout some crazy bit of knowledge.
Yeah, I don't even remember what the context for that was, but I had to look that up. I was like, I know he said that. So I went searching, and it was in Zombie U.
Wow.
I'm like, okay, whatever. So anyway, yeah, so they actually embraced the sort of urban myth around the movie 2001, which I think is kind of funny. But usually the key founders of HAL are given as Satoru Iwata, who actually joined the company in, 1982, after he graduated from college. He was just kind of like a part-time programmer for the company before that. And the other main figure in the company was Masahito Tanimura, who is the current company president. So he's been with them for 35 years.
And I don't know if they're still there, but they were based in Akihabara for a long time. I knew that. Like, that's their list. I was just double-checking it on Google, but that was like their listed address even in their 81 game that they were based in Akihabara.
Hmm. Interesting.
I don't think so because been reading all the history because of Iwata's passing, and one of the reasons he became president is because they built a giant new facility in like around 1990 and then ran out of money. But I guess we'll get there. Okay. Was not in Akihabara.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, that'll be a great story for later. I mostly focused on their games as opposed to the drama and politics and finances around the company's history. But I think the early years of HAL are the ones that are the least known because, again, it wasn't really a formal company in the sense we think of today. It was a company, and Iwata said that his father was like really disappointed in him that he went to become a programmer with his company. I'm sure that eventually changed, but
inevitably.
Pretty much everything they made for the first 4 or 5 years of their existence were just clones of popular games, as was That's the way of computers did. Back then.
Yeah.
But, okay, yeah. So in my notes it says Giant Bomb and a few other sources list Eggerland Mystery as for MSX as their first game. But before that, they were producing all these clones. So I don't know if you guys checked out the YouTube links I sent over, but their earliest games were just like naked ripoffs.
Yeah.
There's a game called Radar Rat Race, which apparently was their first game, and it is straight up Namco's Rally X, except with mice. But it has the same mechanics, like a mouse is running through a maze, being chased by rats, and you have to collect cheese instead of flags, and occasionally there will be like a cat just kind of sitting there. And then the oil slicks or the smoke screen from Rally X is replaced by Magic Stardust. I don't know why.
How whimsical.
But as you play, there's like this kind of bad, slowed down, off-key version of Three Blind Mice playing, and it's just over again. Do, 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 do.
Oh, the old that, days. How
yeah.
classic.
Like, oh, video game music existed back then, but I wish it hadn't. But I mean, like everything about Radar Rat Maze, Rat Race, sorry, looks exactly like Rally X except the sprites and, you know, the fact that it's not as nice looking because originally they published on VIC-20. Like, I thought that was interesting. I know the Japanese computers took a while to become established, but the PC-80 was a thing by that point, wasn't it?
I remember
like
reading
NEC
that.
Had their own Japanese baked and born system.
I remember reading that Iwata like saved up and bought like a VIC-20 or a PET or something like as his first computer, probably in the very early days before the Japanese industry, like in the late 70s as opposed to the early 80s maybe. I really don't know when the Japanese really started developing its own like robust PC architecture like and market.
I should know this, but wasn't the PC-80 didn't it get its name because it was from 1980 or it's was possible. Because it ran on an IBM 8088 chip?
I honestly don't know. I don't know much about the – especially the early days of the Japanese PC.
Yeah, that's an area of expertise that I don't know that much about and probably should have read up a little more before this episode, but I didn't expect to have this question come up. So anyway, it does seem weird that they would focus on the VIC-20. Like even if Iwata was a fan of Commodore's early computers – I wouldn't think that there was much of a market for the VIC-20 in Japan. Maybe I'm mistaken.
People weren't thinking so much in terms of markets then also because, like, as you talked about earlier, it was sort of see the pants, sort of the line between, like, hobby and business was sort of vague, I guess.
Sure. No, I get that. But you'd think that, if it's a super obscure computer that no one owns – that they would want to diversify a little bit, like maybe make some VIC-20 games because that's what they love, and then maybe also make some PC-80 games or
maybe
for other systems.
Like his university had them or something, so who even knows?
It could be it. The next game that came out from HAL in some form or another was called Star Battle, and it was a straight clone of Galaxia, which
they
again,
like Namco.
Yeah. They did.
Or hated them.
Namco and Atari. Their third game was Jupiter Lander, which was just Lunar Lander. Their fourth game was called Road Racer and is supposedly like Night Driver, but watching the videos of Road Racer, it's not that much like Night Driver. Like, it's a top-down racer. But it's kind of hard to watch and really understand. There's just clutter all over the screen. Mm. And you're trying to avoid pretty much everything except dollar signs. But there's no road or anything. You're just like moving around symbols and trying to avoid them. Mm. It doesn't look that good. Like looking at their early games, you would not think, oh, this is the work of the programming savant who would save Nintendo's bacon time and time again. It's definitely the tiny acorn from which a great oak grew. Mm. Anyway, so yeah, they produced a bunch of these kind of VIC-20 PC games. And then once the MSX launched in Japan, which was the summer of 1983, they started to transition over to the MSX. And that to me makes a lot of sense because the MSX, was a home computer, kind of console-ish in that it took cartridges and had sort of a console game sensibility to it, but still very much in the PC vein. And, it was close enough to a console that people have actually put together homebrew conversions of their MSX games, HAL's MSX games for ColecoVision, because they ran on the same fundamental hardware.
Oh.
So it's actually really easy to do MSX to ColecoVision conversions and vice versa. It's something Coleco fans really like to do is do like – take, MSX games that never came to Coleco and just tweak them so that they can run on the ColecoVision.
Everybody's got a hobby.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's a pretty cool one. I really think Eggerland Mystery was kind of the company's first big step as a publisher, as a developer. Like, it was their first original game. And we probably know Eggerland Mystery better as The Adventures of Lolo, which we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The very first Eggerland Mystery is not quite analogous to any of the Lolo games we got in the U.S. The first Lolo was sort of a compilation and remix of a bunch of stages from Eggerland Mystery and its sequel.
Hmm. I had no idea.
And they were tweaked and revised. Yeah, there's a big article on Hardcore Gaming 101 that gives the breakdown of how the Eggerland games worked, and it's as arcane and baroque as Wonder Boy. So, so give it a read sometime when you have some brain space and bandwidth free to be confused a little bit. So yeah, I'm sure everyone here has played the Lolo games.
Yeah, they seem to catch on in the United States because there were three for the NES, right? And then there were the Game Boy ones. I'm pretty sure. I mean, it stopped there, but it seemed like there was a market for that kind of puzzle game. I found them incredibly hard. I still can't play them. My mind doesn't work that way.
Yeah, there were several on MSX, and then on Famicom Disk System and NES. And there's kind of this, like I said, this kind of weird relationship between the US and Japanese versions. But I think Lolo 2 and 3 were basically the same game in the US and Japan.
Mm. And then Lolo became like Dark Kirby, like Kirby's well, enemy.
Yeah, he had a cameo. Lolo and Lala had cameos as an enemy in Kirby's Dreamland.
They're
say?
A boss in Dreamland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a PC like Windows 95 sequel or remake of Lolo that PAL developed. And then that was pretty much it. Like they showed up as of like 10 years ago in that Kirby cartoon coming at you or what back at you or whatever
right.
it's called.
Right back at you. Right
Kirby,
back.
I think Kirby, they're Kirby, now Kirby, Lolo Kirby. And La La La.
Yeah, like, it's still the same character.
Yeah, weird.
The last time I thought of them was because the opening or one of the opening things to Super Meat Boy recreates the opening to Adventures of Lolo.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Hand,
yeah, yeah.
The villain's hand taking away the girl.
And, it's a cute opening. I like that.
Yeah, I had never heard of Sokoban when I first played The Adventures of Lolo and, you know, during the NES days. It was just a game I rented, and I was really impressed by it. It was, you know, kind of a puzzle game, but action-y also, so you needed two sets of skills. You needed to be able to think, like, in terms of the arrangements and space within the stage, but also you needed to think in terms of timing to avoid real-time hazards, moving enemies, things that would fire if you crossed their line of sight. So, you know, a lot of people were making Sokoban clones in 1985. That was, I think Sokoban was 1982 and kind of caught on as Sokoban being like the box puzzle pushing game where you can only push boxes. You can't pull. You're moving them through a maze. We could probably do an episode on Sokoban itself.
It was called Shove It on the Genesis.
Shove It. There's it was Boxel on Boxel. Game Boy.
Yeah.
I remember that tomato guy who was on the cartoon, the acclaimed cartoon.
Quirk?
Yeah.
Quirk was a Sokoban clone, but much better than Sokoban.
Hmm.
I've learned a lot about Sokoban doing Game Boy World.
Where does
because the... Boxel showed up early. Boxel was a direct port of Sokoban. And then, like, every other game after that was a Sokoban clone.
Does Amazing Tater fit into this in any way?
Amazing Tater is somehow connected to Quirk and Spud's Adventure.
Man.
Like, they are a trilogy.
Wow.
And everything after the first one is insanely expensive. Mm. Those are games that I probably will not be able to photograph for Game Boy World because they're like $1,000.
That's
crazy.
They're all from the Salad Kingdom trilogy.
Actually Atlas's PR guy, John Harden, dug up a copy of – like boxed copy of Amazing Tater or Spud's Adventure, one of the two. And, like, tweeted to me and was like, hey, check out what I found just to make me feel bad.
But oh, man.
I am going to their office. I've arranged this. I'm going to their office next time I'm in Irvine and photographing that damn game.
Stand behind the velvet rope.
I will.
When you do it.
I don't want to accidentally fall forward and break it like that kid did with the painting
at
the
man.
Museum. Anyway, so Lolo was actually, you know, of all the Sokoban clones, it was definitely one of the best. It really added a lot of interesting elements. So you're pushing like little boxes around, except they were called emerald framers.
Mm.
And then you had enemies within the maze. There were like these Medusas who would paralyze you if you crossed their line of sight. So you had to use the boxes to obstruct their view while you were also pushing them to the proper places. It was just it was really well done and really clever. The original, the MSX game, Eggerland Mystery, was pretty basic compared to the ones we got on NES, but the elements were still there. And it definitely, like, to me, that shows the signs of promise of how. Like, they took this concept, but instead of just cloning Sokoban, they said, let's make it better and bigger. And they did a good job of it. So I could see where that would become sort of a long-running series for them. I mean, it ran for probably close to a decade if you count the Windows game. Hmm. So that's pretty good. This was back when they were making like six or seven games a year as opposed to one or two. So, you know, getting that many games wasn't too far out of question. other games, their first licensed game was based on Golf Force. Mm. Christian, yeah. Is that something you can tell us about? I don't really know.
Golf Force was one of those like 1980s like movie and or OAV series. I think it's probably both, but I'm not sure.
I think so, yeah.
About a bunch of cute girls with guns in outer space fighting aliens. Mm-hmm. I watched one of the specials back in the VHS days of anime. And
yeah, me
sort of,
too.
I think it's Kenichi Sonoda character designs, okay. The riding bean.
Oh, yeah. I think that's why Animego brought it over, with was cats. The Sonoda connection.
The character designs and the art's adorable. I see it pop up on Twitter and, like, Tumblr sometimes. The show went, like, it was, like, in one ear out the other kind of thing. I just, you know. I remember a weird thing about... like being impregnated with an alien child that, you know, the strange thing that like Japanese stuff can often do, which is like, this seems incredibly superficial. Suddenly it's incredibly melodramatic and like kind of overly deep. What happened? Just turned on a dime.
I only knew it because Animego, I didn't watch actual Golf Force, but I watched it was called the Super Deformed Double Feature, which was the mockumentary of Golf Force. That Animego released. It was like one of the dozen VHSs at my Blockbuster, and so it was about the fake making of Gal Force, where the stars of the show are actresses. It's very strange.
That sounds amazing. I need to watch that. That sounds mm-hmm. great.
And then the other, it's with a thing called Scramble Wars, which I totally forgot about, but it's basically the Wacky Races.
Yeah, it's like kind of a Super Robot Wars, but as an anime, mm-hmm. right? It was like all these different characters from different series getting together. I've never seen it, but I've heard of it.
It was weird. I don't know why my Blockbuster had that VHS, I have to say.
Man, that sort of golden age of Japanese OAVs where they were in the bubble economy and they were just like, just throw some money. Who cares? Just make it big and look beautiful. I miss that era. It was just like everything was so off the wall mm-hmm. as opposed to so formulaic and safe. Ah, the 80s. Anyway, so yeah, they made a top-down shooter based on Golf Force, which really has nothing whatsoever to do with Golf Force, except that at the beginning of the game, you can pick one of the two heroines, which is a little portrait on the title screen that you scroll through, and then after that, it's just like ships in space blowing up stuff. Not that great, but it is kind of cool that they, you know, jumped into the licensing at that point. Like that, to me, is a sign that they were kind of serious as a company.
Or they were a bunch of nerds who watched a lot of anime.
That's also entirely possible.
Yeah.
another notable, a couple of notable MSX games that ended up sort of determining their future for their direction for the future. Hole in One, which was a golf game, and I want to say that they co-developed a couple of NES golf games, didn't they?
That's something.
Open Tournament Golf. Was that it?
Yes. Yeah, they did the Mario, NES Open Tournament Golf. Yeah, that was them, which for Mario nerds, that is the first coupling of Luigi and Daisy. That was the first time they'd been put together pair, which so if your headcanon is that Luigi and Daisy are a couple, that's where it begins.
It's what the movie tells me, and that's where my canon comes from.
There's something – I know you're going to talk about this later. I'm looking at the notes, but – one of the most significant things is even while this was going on, they were already working with Nintendo from very early on. So, I mean, I don't know if we're sort of looks like we're going from...
That's coming up soon.
Yeah, so I'll get there. But yeah, this is all happening at the same time.
Right, yeah. So also in 1984, so I guess before Eggerland Mystery, they produced a game called Rollerball, which sounds like it might have something to do with the sport of the future, but actually was a pinball game. That was kind of Hal's entree into pinball, which is something that they revisited a few times. And their pinball games were always just top notch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, especially Kirby's Pinball Land.
Kirby's
great
Pinball Land
idea.
Was really beloved. But
I was more of a Revenge of the Gator guy.
Yeah, Revenge of the Gator was another one. Like, that was one of the first really great Game Boy games.
You
it was,
get that for
it
like $2
so well
on
done.
The eShop now.
Yeah,
it's totally
super
worth
cheap.
It.
Yeah. But it's definitely, I mean, even though it just has one board, it's a really, or one table, it's a really good pinball game. Mm-hmm. Having played some subsequent Game Boy pinball games by other developers, like, you don't really love what you got until it's gone. Like, playing something like, what developer was that? Jalico's Hiroshigo Pinball Party, which is just this janky piece of pinball garbage. It's terrible.
That's no
it's
party.
Like the physics are awful. The collisions are bad. It's not fun. It's not interesting. It's not attractive. Revenge of the Gator was just HAL kind of doing its HAL thing, which was taking that idea, doing like a really compact version of it and just making it so good. Like the movement of the ball and the way it interacts with the table and the bumpers and the flippers is just fantastic. Like, I can't say enough good things about Revenge of the Gator, which might seem kind of weird because it's just a portable pinball game from 1989, but it was just really well done.
They're good at pinball. They're good at replicating pinball physics.
Like, to me, it's just, you know, kind of HAL in a nutshell. Like, it's this simple thing that you wouldn't think would be that big a deal, but they do it so well. And that kind of love and care is what makes HAL a really great developer. Anyway, so yeah, as Christian mentioned, around this time, around the time of Rollerball and Eggerland Mystery, HAL, and specifically Satoru Iwata, was tapped by Nintendo to just kind of come on and do some programming help for them. And I don't know, I've never seen an explanation of how Nintendo knew, like, oh, we should get in touch with Iwata. Has that ever been explained? I've looked, and I
don't think so. Yeah, I would just assume it was they just knew it was just to talk among people. Oh.
I'm going to say that I read this recently again. I didn't note it down. So I've been reading this book, I Am Error, about the history of the NES.
Oh, we've read it.
Okay. Well, okay, so you know from reading that like it has 6502 processor.
Mm-hmm.
The 6502 was pretty unpopular in Japan. My guess slash thing I think I feel like I read is that Iwata knew how to program for the 6502.
That would do it.
They were looking for people who could. Also, Commodore used 6502s, so it just logically makes sense that even if I'm wrong, I'm going to make this up and say maybe that was why.
No, like, that makes perfect sense. The 6502 was an established processor, but not one that people used a lot.
Established more in the West, not so much in Japan, really the issue.
Mm. Yeah, so okay, that makes sense. I mean, they probably put out like an APB saying, help. We need 6502 experts, and
that's how they
said.
Got the Nakago, the guy who programmed Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers, also, and the Donkey Kong port.
There's a poster. It said, "Uncle Yamauchi wants you."
Yeah,
He
was working on like business.
Toshihiko Nakago.
Yeah, Nakago. He was working on like business software or something, but he knew how to do 6502. So Nintendo was just scouting people who knew how to program Japanese people who knew how to program the 6502 because it was a rare skill in Japan.
So that would explain it. So Iwata. Knew what he needed to do, and Nintendo brought him on to help out with a couple of games. And
Balloon Fight being the significant
the first,
one.
Yeah, the first one they brought on was for Balloon Fight, and it wasn't for the NES version, the Famicom version.
Yeah, it was.
It was the arcade version.
Reverse.
No, I thought so too, but it's not. It was the Famicom version was great, and they brought him on to make the VS version, the arcade version, better.
I swear I just read the opposite thing, though.
I thought so, too, but I've read it a couple of times over the past month or so.
Maybe it's because – I mean, maybe I did read it that way. Maybe it wasn't accurate. You know what I mean? Like, what I read.
One or the other. Like, to me, it makes more sense that the VS version was the better version, but because it was running on a different, you know, like, more robust hardware. But
right.
I think the VS version was made after – the Famicom version, so it might make sense.
I was just reading the Iwata Asks about the history of Super Mario Brothers, and regardless of which version, like which way it went down, I remember the big point of fact was that like Iwata had thought of a way to do the programming for the motion better. Mm-hmm. Were you gonna tell this story?
Well, actually, I was going to say that for the Super Mario Brothers episode. But we can repeat ourselves. It's fine. Go ahead.
We'll
tell it differently.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And he had thought of a way to do it without integers. He was using decimals, so like it was smoother gradations of movement. And he told Nakago about it, and Nakago was like, "Oh, wow, that's a great idea!" And that's how they ended up using it for Mario Swimming.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah,
know
Mario
that.
Swimming is based on Balloon Fight's motion, and
oh,
that's
that makes
something
sense.
That Iwata introduced.
Nice.
Oh, that's like the missing link in my head, just like connecting together. Like, whoa.
So, yeah, he worked on making one version of Balloon Fight. I want to say the Versus arcade version as good as the other version, which the team was having trouble with, to which Shigeru Miyamoto afterwards said, like, why did you guys have to call in outside help to make this happen? This doesn't make sense. But what in any case, I think he made a good impression. He also helped out with Nintendo's pinball. Mm. But as far as I can tell, Iwata had not worked on Rollerball. So it wasn't like they brought him on because they said, oh, you know pinball games because you made a pinball game. It was
I remember not liking pinball all that much anyway.
It's actually not that bad. I mean, for its time, it was a very good pinball game.
I mean, I got it like with my system in 1986.
Yeah, see, I didn't play it. I don't think I played NES pinball till like 89 or 90. And so maybe it just felt super deep.
Were you in the UK?
No. I didn't get an NES until like 88 or something when I was like 6 or 7 and saw my next door neighbor playing Super Mario Brothers. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to keep in mind that NES pinball was released in early 1985 in Japan. Mm. So Super Mario Brothers wasn't out at that point. So those simple kind of arcade experiences were okay. It wasn't until Super Mario Brothers came out that people were like, whoa, this system's capable of a lot. Let's work to this higher standard. But, you know, we got Super Mario Brothers at NES launch. So all those black box games were kind of like, okay, sure. Mm-hmm.
I think it was also an all hands on deck thing at the time, both in terms of why they had Iwata there, but also why they were pumping out things like pinball and whatever. They were like, okay, we have this system. We have to get as many games out like as fast as
possible. Yeah, licensees didn't start showing up until a year after the NES or the Famicom's launch. So Nintendo was totally on its own for a while, kind of like with Wii U.
it's been longer than a year.
And also it was people they had relationships with even then. Like the first licensee was Hudson.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nintendo and Hudson had a close relationship at that point.
Yeah.
So.
And those first licensed games were not good.
Nuts and Milk.
Yeah.
The most popular ROM hack ever.
They did well for themselves, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of the beginning of the Iwata Nintendo connection, which eventually would obviously bear incredible fruit as Iwata became the company president at Nintendo, the first person outside of the Yamauchi family to run the company. So, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
Before we leave Balloon Fight real quick, I did think it was very touching that Hip Tanaka made the remix for Iwata like as a tribute to him after he passed away.
That was great.
Yeah, we put that in the episode that we talked about.
Yeah, I love
passing.
That.
Yeah, it was a nice little tribute. Yeah, last we spoke before our little break, we talked about sort of Hal's introduction to Nintendo, and they continued making MSX games for a few years. As that market slowly tapered away, they shifted over to Famicom development, which I don't think had anything to do with their relationship with Nintendo. It was just what everyone did. Mm. If you were a Japanese game developer, you made Famicom games. That's what you did.
Did they ever officially become like a second or first party developer for Nintendo, or were they always technically a separate company?
I actually don't know. I don't know if Nintendo has a stake in them.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, like they became Nintendo exclusive. Once they stopped making games for MSX, like the only game they made that was not for a Nintendo platform was that Lolo port for Windows 95.
Mm.
Everything else was Nintendo.
Yeah, I wondered if they're just like Game Freak, where Game Freak, like they actually did just put out a game with Sega of all people, but pretty much they're a Nintendo exclusive company.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those, like the relationship was so strong that there's never been any question of like, yes, we make Nintendo games. That's what we do. And I'm assuming Nintendo has a stake in like Kirby. Like, surely Nintendo has some ownership over the character.
I have to think they own Kirby, yeah.
You'd imagine. So, yeah, so I don't know exactly what the rights issues there are.
It's actually hard to – I was very slightly trying to track this down around when Iwata died because I was curious about it. And even, like, looking at, like, Hal's Japanese website, trying to figure out who owns Hal or whatever, or like, Nintendo's financial stuff, it's not really a trivial task.
You would think that if they had actually made you know, made a purchase, bought a stake in HAL, that would be a matter of public record because they are a publicly traded company.
Yeah.
So that leads me to, like, the fact that we've never heard anything along those lines leads me to believe that it's just a partnership and, you know, like a gentleman's agreement or maybe even a contractual agreement.
To me,
like,
it's
Nintendo
like,
helps fund HAL games, but I don't know. Like, all HAL makes anymore are basically, you know, first-party Nintendo games. Kirby, I don't think they've worked on Smash Brothers in a while, but
Yeah, that was a Sora thing since for the last decade or so.
I find it all confusing, like, Game Freak, Creatures, Inc., and the Pokemon Company, and then Nintendo. Like,
well, we talk about
someone
creatures.
Draw me a chart.
We'll talk about Creatures in a little bit.
Okay, cool. I'm glad.
Yeah, so like I said, it made sense that HAL began to focus on the Famicom. I find it interesting that some of their first NES games were NES games, not Famicom games. As far as I know, their ports of Defender 2, Joust, and Millipede weren't released in Japan, were they?
I don't know.
I think they were American only.
Things
American
I would not
only.
Really be worried about in my life would be like Japanese Famicom ports of classic Atari games and whatever.
Yeah, but it is interesting that they would be tapped for creating those games. And apparently their version of Defender 2 is supposedly really good. And there is a little bit of a weird irony in them porting Joust, given that Iwata worked on Balloon Fight.
Which is the best ripoff of
like, yeah, a glorious ripoff of Joust. So yeah, just kind of like an odd little footnote. But most of what they were known for on NES and Famicom were their original games. Some of them were really weird, like Kabuki Quantum Fighter, which is an action platformer in that sort of what Frank Cifaldi calls guy game genre, like Shatterhand and Vice Project Doom, where you're like a dude and you're fighting things in a platformer and it's kind of melee, kind of a shooter.
Yeah.
It's very action-y, kind of hardcore.
Well, you're a dude with beautiful hair that uses a weapon, right?
You are a computer scientist named Scott something. I can't remember. You're like a computer scientist in the military who is converted into a computer program to fight viruses by hand, not with you know, like with McAfee or whatever. And for whatever reason, the astral form you take inside of the computer is of a kabuki dancer who has deadly long red hair.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense to me.
It's just like one of those throw everything into a melting pot and see what happens kind of game concepts that just doesn't happen now. I mean, if it does, it's like people consciously trying to be weird in that NES way, whereas this just came by naturally.
I have a feeling it also probably was one of those things where like, okay, we have this Famicom game. It has a kabuki guy. How do we make this relatable for today's American kids? Like Little Billy, the same way that they took like, you know, Metafight and said like, Little Billy is whatever his name is chasing his frog down into a pit. Oh, look, there's the Sophia too, and now it's
Jason. Jason chasing Fred.
You know, like that's not how Metafight starts in the Japanese version.
Jason right. is a very 80s white little boy
it
name.
Is.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
I
we went from like Chusenki Metafaito to I'm Jason chasing my frog Fred down the nuclear hole in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, wait, maybe your parents should cover that up. My God.
Can you defeat Chris, the ultimate villain?
What was the villain's name in?
Sophia was the car.
Sophia the Third was the name of the AI in the tank. I think the tank was called Nora.
Nora.
Oh, yeah.
No obligations, responsibility, or adults or whatever. And then what was his name? Like the mutant boss or something? Or the
I can't remember.
Anyway, yeah. It's all a digression. But
yeah.
But it was very much in that style. Yeah. I think the game had that same style in Japan though.
I don't know, and it's possible.
Like Kabuki Dancer meets Innards of Computer.
Yeah. Then again, I can imagine them thinking that's cool.
Yeah.
So who knows? But that was a HAL game. Probably their most atypical game. In their entire catalog.
Then again, HAL's catalog is pretty atypical.
That's true. Their NES catalog, Daydreamin' Davy.
That was a HAL game, damn.
That was a HAL game. Air Fortress, which I really need to play. Like, people keep telling me it's a really great mix of Metroid, Blaster Master, kind of got a Baraduke thing. Like, you're a dude on, like, a hover bike that you use to fly through shooter stages, and then you land it, and you go inside of enemy bases on foot, and, like, drop a bomb and then have to escape. So kind of almost like a Wario Land 4 thing where you're, like, blowing up a base and you have to escape each time.
Hmm.
So pretty ambitious, kind of nonlinear levels. What I've seen of it, you know, people playing it, video streams of it, seems interesting. So they were definitely kind of getting into that nonlinear adventure game style that was kind of getting popular on Famicom NES at the latter half of the 80s. Revenge of the Gator, I mentioned. The Lolo trilogy, we talked about a little bit, but that really kind of came into its own on NES and Famicom, Famicom Disk System, and received a few sequels here. Lolo 3 is actually really hard to come by these days, kind of an expensive game. But it looks really good. Like they made a really beautiful Sokoban clone.
I think that game had bosses in it too, like boss fights that looked really cool.
Which isn't totally wacky. I've played Boomer's Adventure in Asmic World, which is kind of a Heianchio Alien Lode Runner trap 'em up style game that also has bosses. They don't work very well. I'm sure Lolo's worked a lot better. We talked a little bit in the break about Vegas Dreams and Vegas Stakes, which apparently is very popular among the older Japanese set.
Oh, yeah. I had mentioned, like, the first time I went to Tokyo on an ANA flight, instead of having, like, you know, crappy Flash games or whatever, they still had SNES games in the back in this entertainment console. And I watched, like, a middle-aged Japanese guy play, like, SNES Vegas Stakes in the seat next to me for, like,
a
whole flight.
I love Vegas Stakes because you can use the mouse. It's, like, one of, like, five Super Nintendo games. But also, like, it adds this extra layer to the gambling experience in that you set off with your friends or, like, you choose a friend who, like, talks to you throughout gambling. And then occasionally, like, people will come up to you like, oh, I need $50 to do something. And you give it to them and either they ripped you off or you are eventually rewarded later. Like there are like these weird like little narrative things that interrupt the gambling and that I find pretty fascinating.
So to me, I don't know this for a fact, but to me the Vegas games that HAL developed strike me as sort of a facelift for the patchy slot genre that was kind of weirdly popular on Japanese consoles. You had games like God, I can't even remember what they're called, but you know, pachinko slot machine games, where basically all you do is like hold down a button and tweak the direction that the balls fly in. It's not very fun, but those are just ubiquitous ubiquitous on Japanese consoles. And after a while, they started to add, like Coconuts Japan and some other developers started to add these kind of adventure game RPG light elements where there would be like a story and you'd be wandering around from different pachinko parlors to other pachinko parlors. Vegas Dreams, Vegas Stakes strikes me as being very much in that vein, except that instead of limiting themselves to the Japanese market, because no one outside of Japan cares about pachinko or patchy slot, they said, well, everyone loves Vegas. Like, everyone loves to gamble, you know, Monte Carlo, Vegas-style gambling. So if we take the same concept and build it around Vegas concepts instead of just pachinko, then we can sell not only to Japanese gamers but also to American gamers. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a pretty smart choice on their part. It definitely, to my knowledge, there's not really anything comparable on the NES library.
It's interesting to didn't Nintendo is in the NES days, like, weren't they afraid of anything resembling gambling, or they were really? I thought they were not the biggest fans of gambling in their games.
Hmm. Well, they sure publish these games. That is true. Allow these games to be licensed.
I remember just like Mario 2 has gambling. You know, just like gambling and slot machines are such a like a part of all like a lot of Japanese games. There's always like a gambling element.
That's true. They do love gambling. It's fun. Well, I love gambling too. I also read that the Vegas in Japan it's just called Viva Las Vegas, the Vegas Dreams.
But then Wayne Newton was going to sue, right?
That's an Elvis song.
Yeah, sorry. I think he wore it best though.
What about Juice Newton?
Juice Newton.
Mm-hmm. I like the
that
one.
That sounds dangerous.
I like the Dead Kennedys one. I like that one. Or is it just Jello Biafra that sings it?
It's Dead Kennedys.
Okay. Mm.
Maybe they did the commercial. Anyway, so the final noteworthy game of the of HAL's 8-bit output, of course, is the Kirby series, which began on Game Boy. But quickly exploded onto other systems. Probably the best known game of the 8-bit era in that series was Kirby's Adventure for NES, which really sort of consolidated all the concepts of the series.
Yeah.
The original Kirby was very simplistic. I'll let you guys talk about it.
Well, yeah. Funny story with Kirby's Adventure is that – and actually I was on a flight to Las Vegas when I learned about the passing of Satoru Iwata, and – the closest thing I had to an Iwata game available to me at the time was the 3D Classics version of Kirby Adventure. And it still really holds up. I think that is the first one where you steal powers, because you don't steal abilities in the original Kirby Dream Land. No.
I think in Kirby's Dream Land 2 you do, but that might have come out after Kirby's Adventure.
Did. Yeah, it did.
But the nicest thing I can say about this game is it got me to play a Nintendo game in 1993 and not care that it wasn't a 16-bit game. Like, I love this game.
Oh, it looked really good.
It looks beautiful. Like, reading that I Am Era book, I'm like, what magic spell did they cast to make Kirby's Adventure happen?
The graphics are very simple, but they're just very well developed.
Animation's great. Yeah,
the animation's great. The color choices and the definition around objects, like everything is just really kind of pushing. I don't want to say pushing the limitations of 8-bit, but using the limitations of 8-bit in really smart ways, not necessarily working around them, but working with them to make just a beautiful cartoon looking game.
That plays really well. Feels
yeah, it
really
does.
Good.
Yeah, still my favorite of the series, I think.
I like Superstar Ultra.
Superstar was their, like, again, another melting
with the
pot. Just do everything.
Their 1997 Super Nintendo release, right? Wasn't it that late? It was like 96
Kirby's
or 97.
Kirby's always last on every system.
It's funny. I mentioned this earlier, I think, but like, I didn't play Kirby on the NES. I didn't play Kirby on the SNES because they're always so late. But then, like, when the N64 came out, I was definitely done with the N64 by the time Kirby 64 came out.
That's 2000 or something, right?
Yeah, I was late. But I was like, you know what? I'm tired of always missing Kirby. I'm going to buy Kirby 64. And it was the last, like, new N64 game I ever bought.
And I really loved the GDC 2011 speech that Iwata gave. And he talked about, you know, localizing Kirby and originally calling him Tinkle Popo and
realizing that wouldn't
sell outside of Japan. So,
yeah. I remember Miyamoto actually, like, gave direct feedback, if I recall correctly, on how they were going to take, like, the Kirby concept that they'd come up with HAL but make it palatable because it was a Nintendo-published game. So I guess this is maybe where they started to get really close to Nintendo, where Nintendo was like, no, we want to give you direct feedback on, like, how the direction you creatively should take your games.
And it was created by Masahiro Sakurai, right? He's the creator. And he did some things later.
An important fact about him, he's immortal. Right?
Is he?
I mean, look at the guy.
Well, he never ages, but he also, based on his descriptions, is in constant chronic pain.
That'll happen, I guess.
That's true.
I think he played too much Kid Icarus Uprising. Oh, snap. I'm sorry, everybody. Ooh. that nerve is still that raw, I guess.
So there is that kind of weird relationship between HAL and Nintendo with the Kirby games. Like, Kirby definitely is a first-party property. Like, you'll never see Kirby on another platform. But HAL's the only developer who's ever made a Kirby game,
Not
to my knowledge.
True.
Feel Plus or whatever?
No.
Oh,
Good Feel.
Yeah,
Kirby's Kirby's Epic Yarn.
Well, they shop them out, or they'll do. I still think HAL is like the godfather of it.
They'll watch over.
But yeah, I'm
pretty sure. Besides, like, Kirby's Epic Yarn, who else?
Squeak Squad was developed by an outside developer, I think.
Oh yeah, also, one of them was by the Minish Cap and
Flagship.
Flagship.
Okamoto's.
That's right. The
terrible labyrinth or the cell phone garbage. What is the game called?
Amazing Mirror.
Cell phone garbage. What's happening?
you could call other players.
It
was a really ambitious idea, but the tech wasn't there.
It's like a Kirby Metroidvania, and it's not very good. But it's like one of those interesting attempts to make something weird and interesting.
Yeah. The weird thing about that one is that they wanted it to be like 4-person multiplayer, but this was on Game Boy Advance, so you had to connect to other people to play this big nonlinear adventure. That's a game that would work probably pretty well on a 3DS, where you have the connectivity, or you could even get like ghost data of other people playing the game or something. But instead, it was like, it just didn't work. And so you'd have like AI dudes running around instead of other players, and they'd screw you up sometimes. There were places where you had to go from one level to another while carrying a certain power and in order to be able to advance. Just a lot of ideas that didn't quite come together. But, you know, that's why HAL should just make all the Kirby games.
No, because Epic Yarn is, like,
one of the
best Kirby games.
It is really good.
I looked into this just a second ago because one of my favorite underrated Kirby games was Kirby's Block Ball, their breakout clone, which also goes back to HAL's history of making clones and stuff. It was a 95 game, well, actually 96 in America Game Boy game.
Whoa.
But it's I just looked that up, that it was really an R&D 1 game that then HAL told them, like, no, Kirby moves like this. So they reworked an R&D 1 game for
it. Well, that's not the only time Kirby was kind of grafted onto something else. There was also Kirby's Avalanche, which was a Puyo Puyo game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's I forgot about that.
So I guess that was probably developed by Compile and then
Yeah, tweaked. It was. It's actually the Super Famicom Puyo Puyo game, just graphic. And so then there's the, of course, Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine is the right. Genesis version.
I prefer to look at Kirby than the ugly American Saturday morning version of Robotnik.
I'm pretty sure Kirby's Dream Course was not a Kirby game to begin with either. Like, it started just as a regular mini golf game, but then they decided to add powers and stuff. Yeah, so I mean that was for the best, really. That game's awesome.
Yeah, I mean that's such a weird but great game. I played that for the first time on Virtual Console.
And great music.
Was
too.
Really surprised by how interesting and good it is.
Sounds like Kirby almost becomes like a virus for HAL games that he just takes over everything.
Kind of. This point they have more of a system in place for Kirby. I talked to them. Talked to some folks at Kirby or at HAL Kirby when the last Kirby game came out for 3DS last year. What was that called?
Triple Deluxe.
Yeah, it's Triple Deluxe. And I said, you know, like, what's the story with all the games? Like, it seems like there's classic Kirby games and then there's weird Kirby games. And they said, well, yeah, that's actually the system we have. It's like an alternating cycle. We make a traditional Kirby game that people can play and be comfortable with. And then the next year or the next time we make a game that's outlandish and experimental, you know, something like Mass Attack or Rainbow Curse or whatever, where it's you know, trying out new ideas and new mechanics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you don't like that, that's okay, because next time we'll make a more traditional Kirby game.
And actually, I would say they've been on a streak of that's been working out for them for a while now. I don't know if we're going to transition to this into a Kirby cast.
But we already
I have strong feelings about the Kirby games lately. They're pretty good.
If you want to hear more, we did one in the 1UP run. So that's probably from 2011, I think.
A Kirby episode?
Yeah.
I don't even remember
Yeah, back
that.
At 1UP.
Wow. But you couldn't even talk about that Wii U Rainbow Curse sequel. Man.
Yeah, or Return to Dreamland.
That's great. Yeah, that just hit Virtual Console, and I ignored it in 2012.
Return to Dreamland is extremely
good.
Yeah, it's way overlooked.
I played it and reviewed it. And that's the only reason I had really knew anything about it, but it was so much better than I expected.
I co-op the whole thing with Fran. Like, we just kind of got it.
Co-op
is
great in that game.
Yeah, it's
I love the
fun.
Co-op hugs. Those are my favorite.
yes. Kirby,
and that's
Kirby
something
hugs.
That's been around since the Super NES era. There was a forum thread I saw recently where they were trying to figure out exactly what Kirby does to people when he hugs them.
I thought he's like feeding them like a bird.
I thought it was mouth to mouth, that's exactly what some people said. They
I
were
thought
like,
it was a kiss.
He's like chewing up food, and he gets food and he chews it up, and then he puts it into their mouths like a mama bird. But that's why it's like a kiss or a hug.
It's very strange. Yeah, it looks much. I think it looks most like a kiss in the Superstar the 16 games one. Yeah.
I don't think we know about Kirby's biology enough to theorize about what's happening.
It's very fluid.
We only just learned about toad biology, so Kirby's the next step.
That's true.
But Kirby is a really interesting series, though, because it's so pastel, and so soft and gentle and kind of effeminate. But sometimes it's kind of intense.
There's a lot of
darkness to it.
There's darkness, and I think that the Kirby franchise typifies in a lot of ways the, like, if you just want to run through the game and, like, you don't even have to be, like, almost not even present, you can sort of make it to the end if you're co-oping or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you want to get all of the, like, the secrets, like, you know, and the Mario series has really embraced this now, too, with, like, you know, 3D World had stamps and stars and stuff, like, off-the-beaten-track stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, the Kirby series really instituted this, like, off-the-beaten-track is challenging, like, main road is not so challenging. And,
yep.
And it's I like it a lot because I think if you play a Kirby game as, like, a person who plays video games, you should definitely be going for all the extras.
Yeah. I also think, like, because Sakurai is so involved with the series, that's why so many of them have, like, a potpourri of extras and so many extra modes and collectibles and junk.
Like, Mass Attack has an RPG, like a Dragon Quest-style RPG you can unlock with Kirby.
I need to play that one.
That's awesome. That game is amazing.
I heard good things about it. Yeah, I haven't played
it
either.
Good.
But Triple Deluxe had, like, 100 keychains that you could find and collect.
And a fighting game mode that's actually really good and then got split off as its own downloadable game.
And
that's also really good.
A game that's okay. Yeah.
The fighting game mode is actually really
good. I love the fight. The fighting game just is a Smash Brothers. Like, it's a great mini Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so yeah, that's there's more to HAL than Kirby, though. So kind of looking at the way the company developed in the 16-bit era, they produced fewer games, but they were still kind of all over the place. They worked on the Super NES version of SimCity, which Bob recently tackled on a micro episode.
That was once a Famicom game. I wonder if they were on board for that version too. It started as a Famicom game.
Did it? And then they didn't publish that version. They just moved it to Super.
Yeah, I was reading an interview with the composer, and she said like her compositions were practically the same between the Famicom and Super Famicom versions. So yeah,
interesting.
Well, that explains probably why it came out so early in the SNES lifespan. Yeah, because it was kind of a sort of a
conversion
surprise,
right?
Yeah,
it was the Eco of its day. another game that is a kind of a personal favorite. It was one of the first, actually, I think it was the first it was an early dungeon crawler for me, Arcana, which is a really kind of a short, compact dungeon crawler compared to something, you know, like Wizardry or Etrian Odyssey.
Yeah.
There's not much to it, but it's got a really interesting style to it. Everything is based, as you might guess by the name, on tarot. And, like, everything, enemies, skills, your characters are all tarot cards. And they all have kind of their own values and... You use cards in battle as special items, and when someone's defeated, their card gets torn, and you're traveling through a maze. It's just a really kind of fun visual conceit, I guess, to sort of spice up an otherwise sort of staid and boring genre. It was an early Super NES game, and definitely one that kind of sticks in my memory as being a lot of fun.
I think back then the tarot card motif was not used in every RPG like it is today. Like,
I mean, Ultima 4 kind of introduced it.
That's true, yeah, yeah.
You didn't really see it a lot in Japanese games. That kind of came into vogue with the Ogre series.
Yeah, They ran with it. I remember getting that game. For some reason, I got fixated on that game. I guess it's just like the way I was at that age, right?
Arcana?
Yeah, I just like decided I wanted it and bought it and then like just played it and was just... I don't know. It was like – I actually was kind of mistrustful of HAL or something, I guess. I feel like if I think back, I didn't know. I never really bought a HAL game before, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to mention, I looked it up on my phone. I had this GamePro, like, book of hints or whatever, and HAL is an ad in the back. It's just their logo. And apparently their catchphrase or tagline or whatever for that era was the Fanatic Specialist, F-U-N, Attic.
Wow.
So they had their own – is that like a tagline, I guess? Or like catchphrase, slogan. That's what I was looking for. Yeah. So they were advertising and stuff back then. It was, I don't know, kind of cool.
Yeah. Arcana, I never bought Arcana, but I rented it and beat it in like a weekend. So it was not a very big RPG, but it was fun and really accessible. I mean, I was kind of an idiot at RPGs at that point. So the fact that I made it through on a rental.
Are we talking about the SNES era now?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
They really didn't make that many SNES games. A lot of them were Kirby. But probably the most important thing for a lot of people that HAL worked on in the Super NES era was Earthbound.
I hate that game.
I know. Bob hates it. But the rest of us
like it.
aren't so distrustful of Earthbound.
What is this? A non-medieval RPG? Get that off. Get it out of here.
But yeah, actually, HAL had worked on the first Mother game also as a co-developer. And then they worked together with Ape on Earthbound. Mother 2, and apparently that game had a really tortuous development cycle and just took forever and wasn't coming together, and Satoru Iwata stepped in and spent like 6 months or a year basically single-handedly salvaging the mechanics and everything of that game and brought it together to become a true RPG classic. But it is really interesting because it's just another one of those instances of Iwata stepping in and saying, "All right, guys, I got it. I'm good."
There's a guy named Tomato on the internet. I think his name is Clyde Mandolin. Yeah, he's great. Like, he's publishing books on localization and stuff like that. Please check him out. But he has taken apart like Earthbound and stuff like that and looked at the programming and he says like it's so ingenious. Like,
well, he did the fan translation for Mother 3.
Yeah, yeah. So he knows a lot about that kind of stuff. But he's like just down to like pathfinding, like how the pizza man finds you in the town is like pretty advanced, like pretty advanced programming for a Super Nintendo game. So. Look up that stuff. Hopefully I can give Jeremy a link to that before the episode goes live. But it's impressive stuff in this game.
Well, so was HAL involved with Mother 3 or was that all just Brownie Brown?
Okay, so Mother 3, no. But HAL did work on Earthbound 64, Mother 64.
Yeah, that's okay. The Mother 3 didn't come
out. But even Iwata couldn't save that one.
Actually, there's a fascinating interview on one of the fan sites for Mother that They did a big interview, Itoi, Iwata, and Miyamoto, when Mother 3 was canceled. The N64 version of Mother
3.
Yeah, and that has stuff about... It's interesting to read stuff from Iwata, like, from before he was the president of Nintendo also, because his way of... his, like, you know, his role and his demeanor and stuff is different as well. That was sort of when Nintendo had sort of roped him in and was having him help a lot with Nintendo, and actually that's part of...
They were grooming him?
Yeah.
Well, he was like a VP. He was an executive, a mid-level executive of some sort for a couple of years before he became the president, right?
He was like a programming director or something. He I can't remember exactly what his title was, but he became the president of HAL.
To save the company, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot – I guess there's a lot to talk about if you want to talk about, like, I don't know how much you covered in the Iwata cast or whatever it ended up being. But
it was very brief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was more like a, oh, wow, he happened. Was a big guy. wow.
The only other SNES game I wanted to talk about really quickly from HAL that I liked a lot, if we're going to transition over to talking more about the company, was Hyperzone. Did anybody else play Hyperzone?
I didn't.
It's totally Mode 7, right? Like it Mode 7-based kind of shootery game.
I think basically, and I don't know what the design for it was, but I think they said they looked at F-Zero, like probably pre-release F-Zero, maybe even literally like we're at Nintendo looking at F-Zero because of their close relationship, and said like, let's do this, but make it a shooter in the like, you know, like Space Harrier vein. So it's like a crossbreed between like Space Harrier and F-Zero, but it's – I got very addicted to it earlier this year. It's very hard, but also very short, and it's just – got great music and cool graphics, and it's just a super lot of fun.
I have played it. It's really cool. Before we leave Mother behind, I do want to note that like the version that HAL was going to make is essentially what Brownie Brown eventually made, just on a different format. Like you can line up like screenshots with dialogue to the final version of the game and like scenes and like battle things
from, like,
and enemies.
There trailers were, that were released before the game.
Yeah, like the really tiny things with the giant N64.com thing in the corner. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of elements that didn't make it, like the things about the real-time clock.
Those yeah, that was
probably,
a big deal.
Things like that were probably what helped bog down the game. And also the fact that the 64DD was a disaster that imploded.
Yeah, everyone in that era wanted to plant a tree and then watch it grow over time. Sorry, Henry.
No, yeah, I mean, maybe was that what hurt Earthbound 64, that they just had all these tools with the 64DD that they wanted to use them? And
I think it just – they had so many ideas. And,
overscope.
Yeah, they just didn't know how to trim that down. When it went to Game Boy Advance, it was a much more limited – system, and so that forced them to, I think, just kind of keep things on track and really focus on creating a good story-driven RPG.
I know when you read that interview that I referenced, they're not, you know, they're not terribly explicit about what was the problem, but they essentially say that, like, we had a bunch of stuff coming together, but to get it all up to the level that we felt comfortable is, like, enough polish to present to people would be more work than is feasible.
Yeah.
Under the circumstances. Mm. And essentially, Iwata at that point had already been sort of like subsumed into Nintendo, which is kind of why I got on this track of talking about Iwata a bit. Like, Nintendo brought him on. And I get the impression from what he did in his career, like before he worked at Nintendo and after, before he moved on to being the president, I think Iwata became like a fixer. Like, he fixed, you know, Balloon Fight. He fixed... We didn't talk about this at all, but he fixed Pokemon Gold and Silver. Do you guys know about this?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He programmed Dragon Warrior. We talked about that in the
US
Quest
version
episode.
Of Dragon Quest.
With Gold and Silver, wasn't it like, okay, I compressed your game. Now you can fit another game in here.
Yeah, he made them be able to put Kanto region inside of it. Because...
Which was one of the last great surprises like that. One of the last great, oh, the game's not over yet surprises, I think.
So he was, and his last big fix was he fixed Melee, Smash Brothers Melee.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Got his hands dirty and fixed that game before, because you know that was GameCube,
and it had to hit December, like it had to be a GameCube launch window, or they'd be in real trouble.
So I don't know, like, you know, it's impossible to know exactly like what his relationship with the company was, but at a certain point, to rewind a bit, like HAL was in trouble. Like we talked about the early era of HAL, and they were, you know, they sort of grew and grew, and they made all these Famicom games and whatever. But the company wasn't doing so well. And right around, I think it was 90 or 91, I'd have to look it up, they built a huge new facility in Tokyo and, you know, moved all the developers over there. But they incurred a huge debt in building a whole new headquarters. And they were like, suddenly things weren't going so well with the games they released, and they were on the verge of bankruptcy. And Iwata was promoted to president, I think under the advice of Yamauchi, if I recall correctly, said, like, you should be president. You fix the company. And that was around when they did Kirby. So it was like right around like the original Kirby game. And that's when things started to turn around for HAL under Iwata. Like they solidified their relationship with Nintendo.
It makes me sad that Arcana almost killed the company.
They sold a ton of copies of Kirby, and they sort of turned the company around. But it was a it's rocky. If you read all these interviews, like when Iwata passed away, I started reading all these different interviews from all these different sources and sort of piecing together this narrative. Mm-hmm. I would love someone else to actually piece together the narrative because it's pretty fascinating. Yeah. Some of the bits and pieces I read. But
no, yeah, I double checked that Akihabara. So they in 92, when he took over, they moved to a smaller building that's identified as near Akihabara, which they have been in ever since. There's a picture of it from the tweet. But
oh, nice.
For the non-listeners to look at.
So one other thing worth mentioning about the Earthbound games that they worked on. I was actually surprised when I was researching this episode that HAL had worked on Pokemon games because I am not a Pokemon follower, so I never really played, what was it, Pokemon Snap, Pokemon Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm kind of familiar with their existence, but not
Snap not
really
is like one of those cult classic games.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know people love it. I just haven't really played much of it. So I didn't realize that was a HAL game. But, you know, I started thinking about it, like, how did HAL get involved in these? And the co-developer on Earthbound and Mother 3, I think, Ape, became Creatures, Inc., which is one of the three rights holders to the Pokemon franchise. There's Nintendo, Creatures, Inc.,
Game Freak,
and the Pokemon Company. So I guess that's four rights holders. Creatures, Inc. is the company that is kind of responsible for the characters, the creatures, and sort of oversees the spin-off games. So basically, the company that made – the developer that made Earthbound became the company that works on all the Pokemon spinoffs and kind of has that role. So naturally, it makes sense that when they started making spinoffs, they would go to the company that – the developer who helped them so much with the Earthbound games and brought HAL into that.
Boy, that's so funny because I had asked – I've interviewed the Game Freak guys a couple times and I asked them, like, hey, would you guys ever make a sequel to Pokemon Snap? And now I feel like a total idiot because, yeah, they replied with, that was a HAL game. It wasn't ours. Like, we wouldn't make the sequel if we ever did, you know? But I loved – Pokemon Snap came out at a great time in Pokemon fever in America because it's based on the anime. Like, you meet anime – Professor Oak, the anime Professor Oak is giving you directions, and the main character of the game got integrated into the anime for several episodes, which conveniently aired in America at the same time as the game was coming out. And so you see the anime was just showing you this is the world that Pokemon live in, and they're everywhere. And here's this game that in good graphics for the time was showing you here are Pokemon hanging out together. Here's Pikachu jumping on a surfboard and a Scyther jumped out of this bush. Ah!
Yeah, it was a chance to, I guess, not that I have the expert opinion here, but a chance to kind of see the Pokemon world in a different light as opposed to like, here's the world of humans who are enslaving the Pokemon. Like, here's the Pokemon in their
what
natural
are you,
habitat. Yes, I am the variable. So the last of the big HAL games we haven't talked about is maybe the biggest, Smash Brothers.
I think so.
Yeah, I kind of forgot that they made Smash Brothers.
Yeah, they made the first two, right?
The thing is now everyone makes Smash Brothers. It's right, like every Japanese company, like Game Arts. And,
right.
Yeah.
I think it more is coalescing from the ether of Japan game industry, but Namco, there was a point when just Sakurai was making it.
Yeah, Namco worked on the most recent one, right?
Yeah, Namco and
Tekken folks. But,
I mean, I was even looking on Wikipedia, like HAL is sort of labeled as a co-developer on it too. I think lots of people just got involved in it.
I read like Game Arts was big on.
Oh no, Game Arts coded
they did that
the
Ninja
last
Turtles game.
One.
Oh wow,
Brawl.
Okay.
They did Brawl. Mm.
Well, because Sora Limited or Project Sora, like they just weren't big enough to do us.
Well,
Smash
Sora,
I thought Sora just existed explicitly for
Uprising.
Kid Icarus.
Yeah, Sora was only a developer, like a. Like, here are a bunch of people sitting in cubicles, like, typing out programming code during Kid Icarus.
I see.
You know, like,
The thing about Smash Brothers, though, is like when it launched or when it was preparing to launch, like this was the height of like Nintendo is for kids. And I think like me and a lot of other people were very dismissive of this idea. Like, yeah, I'm going to have Mario fight Yoshi. That's real cool. But
not only Mario and Yoshi, but toys of Mario and Yoshi.
Yeah, that was the
conceit.
They
were all fighting in a toy box. They were not the real Mario and Yoshi.
Yeah, that's why.
That's even more like for kids.
That's what Nintendo tells themselves to sleep better at night. Like, it's not really Mario punching Princess Peach. It's a toy.
Probably was, imagination.
Actually. Yeah, I'll tell. Well, I think that's like, speaking of Pokemon spinoffs, there's this Pokemon Rumble games make it very clear those are wind-up toys fighting each other. It's just, that's why I think it's very strange at Pokken Tournament they get away with saying like, no, these are Pokemon punching the crap out of each other.
They do that in Pokemon.
Yeah.
They do, but they still shy away from that, like actually like showing
explicitly
it.
Explicitly.
Oh, the Pokemon fainted.
Yeah, they fainted.
Not only that, but you know, you see like trap, trap, trap. You don't actually see like a Pokemon run up and smack the other Pokemon in the face. You know, you just see the little effect.
Yeah.
And that, like, Smash Brothers originated with Sakurai making a game that wasn't even, like, it was just dudes. It was a
prototype, and I think, yeah. If I recall correctly, it was, like, in his spare time.
Yeah. I recall he had a really hard time selling the idea to Nintendo or, like, to other people. Like, they thought it was just too weird or maybe just not off-brand or something.
Well, also, not Nintendo enough.
Nintendo at the time, especially, like, I don't know if you remember, like, the PlayStation/N64 era. I mean, I'm sure you do, but like, Yamauchi was like he was not a big fan of the way games were going at the time.
If anyone else is doing it, I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Play your RPGs, you freaks.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a feeling that
losers with brown hair.
Ooh, brown hair burn.
Probably that overriding emphasis on that kind of stuff made it harder hard stuff. He said, like, you know, like it never would have happened if it was like, you know, realistic. "Quote unquote realistic people like Tekken or Virtua Fighter or something, right? Mm-hmm. It would have.
Well, and I also remember being a fan at the time and hearing, you know, and when it first was getting promoted in Japan, there was talk on the IGN forums I was frequenting, like, "Will this even come to America? It's too weird," or "NOA won't be into it." I figured it would. There were other crossover games like that did not come to America before.
Weird. It wasn't even that much of a crossover at first. It was really mostly Mario characters.
Well, because Mario is the Pokemon, most populous there is. Like,
but yeah. was Link in the original?
He was, Smash Brothers? He's on the cover.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
The ugly cover of the N64 game.
I like how we, like, off, like I said, again, off brand, like Link has just like giant black pupils and no like real face to speak of. It's strange.
Well, yeah, if you look at the concept art for other characters, it looks like something they wouldn't approve now. Like,
yeah.
Or even 2 years later, the GameCube Nintendo people would not have approved that character art for
this. Maybe that was just part of the toy conceit that they were using.
Yeah.
Like, they look a little different because they're toys, right? Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm.
And then Smash Brothers it really did, I think, invent a kind of Nintendo fan you see today who are just they're just into the Nintendo canon and head canon and making web series about just all the relationships they make up between the fighters and Smash Brothers.
I think as much as like the NES era kids like me, Parrish, whatever, like want to think of ourselves as like the OG Nintendo fans, I think what defines today's Nintendo fandom is the kids who grew up with N64, honestly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the modern 20-year-olds, I guess.
Yeah,
what's a third party?
The stuff, the stuff they were talking about, also like the like we're releasing you know, the remake of Alpha, Omega, Sapphire, whatever. Most Oris.
Ruby and Sapphire. Yes.
There you go. And they that was the same time like Smash Brothers originally came out, and Melee, and like we're gonna reawaken those fans to like buy 3DSs. Like that was like Nintendo's strategy for those two titles. Yeah. They're like, we'll
reawaken
those fans.
Right.
It's time moving forward. Oh, yeah. I don't like now that the remakes of Red and Green are now getting old enough to be remade again.
I was an adult then. I don't want this remade. One thing about Smash Brothers that I wanted to point out is the fact that it introduced like more people to Earthbound than Earthbound did, I think. Like,
oh, yeah.
And Fire Emblem.
And Fire Emblem, you're right. That was Melee. But
yeah. We probably would have never had an English language Fire Emblem, or it would have been a long time before we would have if it wasn't for Marth and Roy in Melee.
But I was part of like the tiny Earthbound communities that were like floating around back then, and the release of this game brought a million people in, like not literally a million, but a lot of people
jumped on board.
A lot of fake Earthbound gamers.
Accidentally well timed with like the rise of emulation.
Oh, for
also,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
like both of those happening kind of concurrently, sort of broke open Earthbound for like the people who actually became its like giant
fan base.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if most people listening to this, or a lot of them, found Earthbound through Smash Brothers.
Much wrap it up at this point. There's actually not too much more to say about HAL at this point. They, you know, they mostly make Kirby games and some other little side projects. The most recent creation they've put together was Box Boy.
That's great.
Which was really kind of a return to that sort of weird, like anything goes NES aesthetic. Bob, do you want to talk about that at all?
Box Boy is, if you hate block pushing puzzles, it is the most reasonable one because you can always move back a step and you're only asked to do a few moves at once. So you're not like, how do I approach this entire room that has 30 things I need to do? It's still difficult, but it's very, very reasonable and very friendly, but not easy. Like, and it has this very minimalistic style. Like, I love that game. I think I gave it like a 4 out of 5 for US Gamer when I reviewed it. It's great.
Yeah, Box Boy is the type of game I dreamed of Nintendo making when they said they'd start making downloadable games, you know, instead of just more Mario versus Donkey Kong than I ever want to play.
We're on the, what, 8th one? I don't know.
Too funny.
At least kid. 3, yeah.
That's made by Americans. I don't like it.
Henry does not want to see minis marching. That's for
better
sure.
Better minis than minions.
That's true. Oh, thank God. Oh, it just made the minis better.
Yeah. So HAL, in summary, pretty much best defined as an essential partner for Nintendo. Also defined by the huge role that Satoru Iwata played in the company and then later Nintendo.
Yeah. It's
It's hard to think about the two of them separately.
The more I read about Iwata and HAL and Nintendo in the last, you know, all the stuff we've been talking about, the more I realized that they were inextricable pretty early on.
Yeah.
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 They were thick as thieves.
And not just Iwata, but also like...
Thieves stealing the joust concept.
if you take Masahiro Sakurai out of it, like you have a very different, I guess... Nintendo fandom, at least, would be very different than it is today without Sakurai with Kirby and Smash Brothers and I guess Kid Icarus Uprising. Like, I think everyone forgot that happened.
They wouldn't be as insufferable about Evo.
Oh, no way. Yeah. And were you in the E3 where it was Sakurai presenting? It was where they announced Pac-Man for Smash.
I was.
Oh, yeah.
You were sitting right next to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I was there.
I felt so bad for Sakurai because he was like cornered with a bunch of the mega Smash Brothers fans there who were just like, could I make your game too?
Jeez.
Yeah. Or this was better in Melee than Brawl. Why
I
didn't
can't
you
believe
mess
you
up
changed
Brawl?
The frame timing. Those two frames make a big difference.
I felt like I have to assume that's what hell is like for Sakurai.
All right. I don't want to bag on Smash
That's
Brothers
why he's in pain every day.
Sakurai had the best damn comeback in there when the guy said, if I beat you in a game, can I help you with bouncing it? And he said, have you ever made a game before?
I'm just like, oh. Sit down.
Sakurai is a genius as far as I'm concerned.
He's amazing.
Anyway, so final thoughts. What to you is the essence of HAL, Bob?
I would say Kirby for the most part, especially with what Henry said about how the games have all this extra stuff jammed into them, mm-hmm. like all these extra modes. I feel like just making a Kirby game is not enough for HAL. They want to put extra stuff in there too. And a lot of care is put into those games, and I love them, even if they are a little easy. So that really, I don't know, HAL is Kirby to me, even though I respect them for Earthbound and things like that.
To me, HAL is an overwhelming cuteness,
yeah.
but underneath it is, you know, they don't lean on it too hard. Their things are super cute, but they don't use that as an excuse to be like to not make well-designed games or to skimp on gameplay.
Yeah, I mean, what I think about when I think of HAL and like the recent Kirby games is this sort of like, yeah. This underneath the pastel, there's sort of like this like steel will, like if you play the some of the more recent powers they've introduced in like the later Kirby games, like the Wii One or Triple Deluxe, which is based on that, like there's a lot of depth, probably unnecessary depth,
yeah.
in the way you can actually manipulate and control Kirby as these like the fighter and stuff to move, and I think that's HAL is this sort of
pastel colored fighting machine. It's kind of it's kind of a weird dichotomy, but yeah,
I like it.
So to me, I would say the essence of HAL is actually Earthbound, in that it was a game that HAL didn't create, but HAL made it better. They made it work.
They made it possible.
Yeah, to me, to me, HAL is best not as like the standalone entity, but as a partner, as someone who collaborates. And like I kind of feel like the story of how they brought Earthbound together really sort of defines that. It really typifies it. So even though it wasn't their game, it might seem kind of weird to say like this is essential HAL. Like the role they played there was really important and really kind of, I think, speaks well to the company's status and legacy as sort of a pinch hitter. So that's where I'm going with that. Anyway, we do need to wrap up this episode. So thanks, everyone, for listening. As always, you can find us at Retronauts.com, subscribe on YouTube or iTunes or YouTube, whatever.
YouTunes and iTube.
Yes. Check us out at usgamer.net, where we'll have full info on this episode and provide some show notes. And as for myself, you can find me at usgamer.net, on Twitter as GameSpite, and read my cool stuff at GameBoyWorld.com. Christian?
Well, you can always find me at Gamasutra. You can always find me on Twitter at Ferricide. And if you find me there, you'll find me anywhere.
And I'm HENEREYG on Twitter. I now work pretty much full time on LaserTimePodcast.com, where I do a ton of other podcasts. So if you didn't hate my voice on this, go over there and check out all these great podcasts I do and streams and all that stuff. And also we have a Patreon, patreon.com/LaserTime, if you wanted to support that.
And you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write for US Gamer, Something Awful, and I have a podcast called Talking Simpsons, which should be available on iTunes right now if you're listening to this, probably.
And, of course, you can support Retronauts on Patreon to help feed these poor starving children and make the podcast possible. That would be awesome. Anyway, that wraps it up for this episode. We'll be back again next week with a tiny episode, and the week after that with a big one.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.